Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Continuing with the chapter, A Buddha in Every Realm, and this is the last section, entitled, There is the Unborn, the Unoriginated, the Uncreated, the Unformed. Please. Is there somebody else at the back there? We use these reflections to let go of the content of experience, to be open to the process of experiencing. Buddha introduced the contemplations on anicca, dukkha, anatta at the very beginning of his teaching career, when he spoke to his five companions just after his enlightenment. He used these three characteristics as a way of exploring experience. They are tools for investigation rather than a philosophical position. So, the Buddha is not saying that you should believe everything is not self. He's inviting us to take this principle and use it to explore our habits of thinking, our attitudes. So, as I was saying before, and as we chanted, not today, we did the fire sermon today, but I think a day or so ago, we chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And we have the translation on the opposite pages to that in the chanting book, so that's a very easy access to the meaning there. And as you can tell by going through each of the five khandhas, the Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, then the methodology that the Buddha uses with each one, so he sort of leads all of his companions through, so bit by bit. It's just a way of analysis, what they call the Vibhajyavada, or the way of deconstructing or analyzing. And so he starts off by saying, rupa, rupang nichangwa anichangwa. So material form, is it changed or does it not change? Yeah. So he starts off with the most visible, most tangible aspect. So the world of material form, is it changing or is it not changing? Okay, yes. Nichangwa, it's changing. And then he says, that which is changing, is it subject to affliction or not subject to affliction? He says, yeah, it's subject to affliction. Then he says, so that which is in a state of change and which is subject to affliction, which is not totally satisfactory, is it appropriate to say of that, this is me, this is what I am, this is mine, this is what I am, this is myself? No he tang bante. Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. So one thing I don't understand about that particular chanting sermon is, like, usually there's a very logical order, but it says everything's changing, and is that which is changing, is that suffering? But why is that inherently suffering? It's as if we expected to believe that assumption, but that isn't actually my assumption when I look at it. I don't assume that everything that's changing is painful, but it seems to be an assumption in that sermon.
Yeah, well, good point. The logic behind it is that if something is in a state of change, if it's pleasant now, then that pleasantness will come to an end. Or if it's painful now, it's already painful. And so that the unsatisfactory, is it subject to affliction? It doesn't mean to say it's necessarily sort of dukkha right away, but if a thing is in a state of change, then it can't possibly be permanently pleasing. So that's why it's subject to affliction.
Because my understanding was that pain comes from clinging, wanting it to stay the same, but if you know it's changing in you.
Well, that's the thing, is that we don't. See, yeah. There isn't that appreciation that the habits of attitude are, oh, this is great, yeah. Keep this. Or like this coming out of the temple, there's this beautiful, luminous pink, sort of mauve pink sky. Ooh. So how many of us thought, camera, yeah. Quick, get it, or at least linger and soak it up. So I did soak it up for a few seconds. You know, it's really enjoyable, but it is interesting, even when the sky is luminous like that, at the dawn or on the evening, even when there is that kind of ultraviolet sort of brightness to it, as you sort of fix your gaze on it, that initial, wow, it can't stay. Your mind can't stay in a state of wow. That the dopamine receptors adapt. If I remember correctly, that's particularly a bit of the brain. That sort of wow, the wowness can only stay for a certain amount of time. So that's why it's subject to affliction. And if you stood there for longer, you know, trying to hang on to it, then it would, as William Blake put it, it would the winged life destroy. That he that kisseth a joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. He that binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. William Blake, so excuse the gender-specific pronouns, but it's William Blake, it was 200 years ago. So that's the logic of it. And so we wouldn't make that association immediately, but that's the principle behind it. So to carry on. After his enlightenment, the Buddha was travelling to the deer park in Varanasi to reconnect with his 5 former companions. He met a wanderer named Upaka along the road. Upaka, I mentioned him yesterday, the day before. Upaka thought to himself, wow, or the Magadhi's equivalent, whatever wow is in Pali. Wow, this monk looks really radiant and peaceful. Upaka said to the Buddha, you look like you've just had some kind of great awakening or some powerful experience. The Buddha said, yes, I'm fully enlightened, and I'm the only enlightened being in the whole world. Upaka was a bit shocked. I think we've all met people who speak like this on the street. I met one in Rome not long ago. It was an interesting encounter. I was on my way to the Vatican. So I could say, excuse me, I haven't got time to talk. I'm on my way to the Vatican. He's a very luminous Christian guy. Upaka said, it sounds like that you claim to have realized the deathless. If that's the case, who's your teacher? How did you awaken to this? The Buddha said, this is all paraphrasing, this isn't precise quotations. Yes, that's correct. I have realized the deathless, but I have no teacher. I realized this completely by myself. Upaka said, well, good for you, friend. Rather as I did with the fellow in Rome. And then shaking his head, Upaka left by a different road. In this account, Upaka spoke to the Buddha about the deathless, quote-unquote. This term might be unfamiliar to some, although it's common within the Buddha's teachings. It's one of the qualities of Dhamma in its transcendent aspect. One of the most significant teachings, and one of Ajahn Sumedho's favorite passages from the scriptures, is where the Buddha says, there is the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed. And if there was not the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, then escape from the born, the originated, the created, and the formed would not be possible. But because there is the unborn, the unoriginated, the uncreated, the unformed, therefore escape from the born, the originated, the created, and the formed is possible. So we chant that fairly regularly here. So from the Udana. Chapter 8 of the Udana. So this teaching points to the transcendent dimension of reality, beyond time and space and identity. The main aspect of awakening is the embodiment of the realization of that transcendent quality. That's why it's called liberation from birth and death. So any other questions on that before continuing? Yes.
It's not exactly on this, but it was earlier I was reflecting on desire and aversion. And I've come to sort of idea that maybe at the moment I'm feeling more desire than aversion. And then the four sort of put to the mind saying, oh, hang on a minute, are you sure about that? And I wondered whether actually any experience of desire, even if you don't follow it, but having an experience of desire, you can have an equal and opposite amount of aversion. Some point,
absolutely, yes. There's no limit.
But you can't just have a bit of desire and no aversion. Is that?
You mean aversion in terms of disappointment or experiencing the liability?
Yeah. Is it possible to, you're not following out, is it possible to sort of, let's say, either see a bit of cake and have some desire, maybe not act it out, but you just because you've actually experienced some desire, is it? You're going to have kind of an equal opposite amount of...
No, not necessarily. No, people have different character types. There's a whole book of the Abhidhamma called the Pugala Panyati, the different kinds of human character types. And also in the Visuddhimagga, you've got lots of descriptions of... So there are basically greed types, aversion types, and delusion types. And we tend to favour one particular track, but it's not confined to just... I'm a strictly delusion type, and I never do greed and aversion. There's usually a mixture of all of them, but in terms of character types, then there's often one that the mind inclines towards. So I tend to be more of a greed type rather than an aversion type. And so other people are more of a aversion type. And I told a story, I think, a few weeks ago about one of the... He's actually now a Thera, he's an elder monk, but when he was an Anagarika, he had a very strong habit of complaining about everything. I was like, his basic relationship to life was to find some complaint. He wasn't particularly so angry or upset, it was just that was how he related, was that what was wrong with things. And he was a very good driver, and he used to do a lot of driving, and California is a big place. It's much, you do a lot more time on the road than you do here in Britain. So the monastery was about 2.5-3 hours drive from the city of San Francisco or Berkeley. So I spent a lot of time on the highway. So one time we were making a trip down from the monastery to the Bay Area, and we were about an hour and a half out of the monastery, and in a fairly steady stream of grumbling of one kind or another. And I realize I'm being recorded, and he'll probably get to hear this. He knows that's about me. He's also pretty sharp, so he would figure it out. And so about somewhere around Santa Rosa, about an hour and a half out of Ayagiri, I said, no one has ever developed the path of complaining their way to Nibbana. It's a completely new spiritual... You're breaking spiritual ground here. This is a completely unique spiritual path, is the way of complaining. Also, California has a lot of self-help books. So you see these, the way of this, that, and the other. It's very, very common. There's a lot of great variety. So, I've never seen the way of complaining. It's a sort of spiritual path. He did get the point. One of the aspects of developing mindfulness and being a well-rounded person, a sapurisa, is getting to know your own character, atanyita. It's getting to know your own personality. Do you hear yourself complaining about everything, or do you hear yourself praising everything or wanting everything, or just being confused about everything? What's the dominant trait of the mind? Are you prone towards doubt? Like, I've never been much of a doubter. So aversion and doubt I don't do much of, but greed I'm really good at. So that's kind of that's why I have a kuti full of books. It's like, oh, there's more things to read. So it manifests around words a lot. So get to know what your own character is. And you can't just sort of snap your fingers and be different. But if you see that there's aspects of your character, like complaining and criticizing and contending against other people, that is harmful to yourself and others, then along with recognizing that trait, then it's helpful to train yourself just not to follow it, compulsive or just an unconscious way. So, there's not a strict proportion, like, you spent so much time following a greedy impulse and therefore there'll be aversion. Doesn't seem to work quite that way. Okay, so to continue. One of the most significant things that we recite when recollecting the attributes of the Triple Gem are the qualities of the Dhamma, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation. To speak of the timeless, the unborn, the deathless, might sound a bit spacey and remote, a bit airy-fairy. However, it's not referring to some supercosmic realm somewhere else. Rather, it is the fabric of our own heart. This is the Dhamma. The aim of Buddhist practice is to discover this liberated quality of our own being that we've had with us all the time. It's the very foundation of what we are, but we've not noticed it, having been preoccupied with worldly concerns. To borrow a phrase from Christian tradition, it's closer to us than we are to ourselves. So, to continue the story, the Buddha was a very quick learner. He realized that a straightforward declaration like that was not helpful, seeing that Upaka shook his head and went off by a different path. Okay, well, that didn't work. So when he met with his five friends, he adopted a method of analysis. That's the Vibhajyavada. Rather than telling them this is the ultimate reality, he used a way of reflecting on anicca, dukkha, and anatta to help his friends arrive at that realization for themselves. They started off with anicca and the body. He asked, is the body changing? Is the body in a state of change? They answered, yes. Then he asked, if something is changing, is it subject to affliction or not subject to affliction? Then they answered, it is subject to affliction. The body can be sick. It can break apart. Then the Buddha asked, if something is changing, if it's subject to affliction, then is it something that can be permanently satisfactory? They answered, it can't be permanently satisfactory if it's subject to affliction and is in a state of change. It is necessarily dukkha, unsatisfactory. Then the Buddha asked, so, if the body is in a state of change, subject to affliction, and is unsatisfactory, is it appropriate to say of it, this is mine, this is what I am, this is my true self? Etang mama eso hamasmi eso me ata. And so mama, the Pali word mama, it means mine, and I don't think it's an accident that it's the primordial sound of a baby to the mother, and that's why the word mother is very similar in very many, many languages. So the the baby sort of expressing the presence of happiness of the presence of the mother, and that also, I feel that primordial sense of owning that the baby feels the mother is mine. And that it might not be related at all, but that's the Pali word for mine, is mama. And so it might be a completely false etymology, but I do feel there's a connection there, that sense of owning. And so when the mother is absent, then the child can be very upset. And when the mother is present, then the child can be very happy that they've got what is theirs. I mean, they're not thinking in words, but they are... that's the feeling of the comforting and reassuring, nourishing presence of the mother. So, etang mama eso hamasmi. Asmi is I am, the verb to be, I am. And atta is like the Sanskrit word atman. Atta is a self. And sometimes that third one is referred to in terms of theories about a self. That you have a belief that the self is eternal, or the self is universal, or the self exists in a particular state, or so after death. But I feel it's more helpful to see that these are they're much more close to home. It's not so much having that third one is so that the first one is the owning self that which is related to tanha. To craving, to owning, to having. And then the second one, asmi, is related to being, so being self. And the third one I like to call the narrative self, so that this is, I am Ajahn Amara, that's my name, or I am 65 years old, or I'm British, or I have a dual nationality, I live at Amravati. You know, our story, our name, our background, our place where we were born, and so on. But those are also aspects of the selfing that is very, very solid and real, and and inarguable for most of us. So those are called the papancha dhammas, tanha, mana, and ditti, that view, represented by those three statements in the Anathalakana Sutta. The etam mama eso hamasmi eso me ata. So tanha, mana, and ditti, craving, conceit, and views. And they're called the papancha dhammas because they're the fuel, they're the kind of energy source, the fuel source for that conceptual proliferation, the I-making and mind-making, my story, my things, what I am, what belongs to me, all of that is fuel for complication and proliferation. So they're known as the papancha dhammas, those three, tanha, mana, and ditti. So anyway, the five companions replied, no, it's not appropriate to say that. In the Buddha's time, as with Vedic philosophy today, there was the idea of the Atman, the self, and the Atman was thought of as being permanent and blissful and truly who and what we are. Its qualities comprising Sat, Chit, Ananda, being, consciousness, bliss. So in a sense, the Buddha was aiming right at those beliefs of his time. If the characteristics of Atman are meant to include permanence and bliss, the body cannot be Atman, it cannot be Atta, Pali. So that's part of the background of why the Buddha was talking in that particular way, was because that's if there is a self, then if there is truly an Atman, an Atta, then it would have those, it would be blissful and would be stable. Being, consciousness, bliss. In his teaching to the group of his companions, the Buddha goes through each of the five khandhas. The first is rupa, material form, just as described. The second is feeling, vedana. The third is sanya, perception. The fourth is sankhara, mental formations. The fifth is vijnana, consciousness based on the senses. It's very systematic. First, there is the exploration of the physical realm, rupa. The other four aspects are of mind, nama. The Buddha says that each of those khandhas is in a state of change, is subject to affliction, and is not permanently satisfying. He says that these khandhas are impersonal. They cannot be said to be a true self, who we really are, or our fundamental nature. Ne tang mama ne so hamasmi na me so me ata te. This is not mine, this is not what I am, this is not myself. When we focus upon the characteristics of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, keeping those in mind as an ongoing reflection, and we look at the result of that reflection, how does it change our heart? In that moment of non-grasping, what is the quality of experience? This has to be known, to be realized by each individual for themselves, but the Buddha pointed out that it is when the grasping stops that the deathless is realized. This is the deathless, namely, the liberation of mind through not clinging. So there's quite a lot in there, and again, these readings are for all of you, not just for me to be spouting more words, but if there's anything there that's not clear or would like a bit more sorting through, then please do speak up.
Sorry, I didn't ask another question.
Please, yes.
That's allowed. Yes. Yeah. Something that, is because you mentioned tanha,
tanha, mana, and ditti.
Conceited. Views. It occurs to me that firstly, fetters are kind of to do with views. Second two fetters are to do with sort of craving, and the last five to do with, well, they include conceit anyway.
They do, yeah.
So is there sort of also a kind of link with sort of verbal formations, bodily formations, and mental formations, or is that a step too far?
It could be, I hadn't thought of it that way. Certainly the first one, that matches up somewhat. Not totally, but somewhat. I'm not quite sure, because the second lot on the sense, desire, and ill will, they're not particularly related to verbal formation.
I mean, bodily formation.
Oh, sorry.
Verbal for the first three, it's kind of, I think I've heard Nampo Sumedho saying that it's to do with thinking.
I think it's a little bit of a stretch.
Okay.
I mean, it's okay. The stretching is all right. I've done some very, very imaginative bits of sort of guesswork and joining up the dots in strange ways myself. But
You don't really see that.
It doesn't ring very, very true, but certainly the first three of the fetters, self-view, doubt, and attachment to conventions, they are in a way associated with that sort of coarse kinds of clinging. With all of these lists of different qualities and that, it's helpful. I find it's helpful to sort of take the particular terms and just sort of sit on them and you bring them into the meditation and to explore. Okay, how do I feel that, or what is that? Okay, I know the word, and I've got the idea of what it means. Well, what does that? How does that map onto my own experience? Like with doubt, vichikicca, doubt is the second of the fetters of those ten fetters. So it's helpful to think, to consider, okay, well, what kind of doubt is that? Is it doubt about whether to have an apple or an orange? Probably not. So what does that doubt refer to? And then if you explore it and look into it, then you find, oh, it's quite specific. It's a doubt about what's the path and what's not the path. Aha, okay, that makes sense. So it's not just any kind of questioning, it's that particular kind of a doubt. So when people say, talking about stream entry, is it going beyond doubt? It's not doubt about which fruit to choose, but it's not just being decisive, but it's that sense of knowing what the path is and not being able to forget that. It's clear what needs to be done. And so that's kind of picking up particular terms and getting to know them, so that's, you're really practicing with the teaching and putting it to work. And then, as I've said once or twice before, if we come across things that is just confusing, like, what does that mean? How does that work? I don't get that. Then just to sort of park that on a shelf to say, well, okay, that's, I'm interested in that, but I really can't get a sense of what that means or what that's talking about. Mysterious to me. So just to leave it there and just to bring attention to it from time to time, but don't try and feel that you've got to work it out, or you've got to just think your way through it and figure out an answer, because if all you're using is the conceptual mind and sort of memory and language and imagination, it often isn't going to do the job very well. And so sometimes just having something that sort of sits there that is mysterious. Like I've talked about with dependent origination, as some of those, particularly in the earlier parts of the process. So what does that mean? Ignorance conditions formations, or formations conditions consciousness. What the? How does? Huh? It's like a big blank. Like, what? How does that work? Or what's that about? Yeah, I can understand what the words are, and I can remember what the words are, but so what? It's just as if it was in a completely foreign language that I don't know what it means. So in that kind of a way, I just sort of let those sit there for quite some time. And it wasn't really until being with Lumpur Sumato here in the late 80s, when he was teaching about dependent origination every winter retreat, and sort of going through it bit by bit by bit by bit, okay, there's that aspect to it. Okay, well, maybe that's what that means. And then sitting with it, doing the periods of formal practice and just sort of pondering, looking at the particular words or connections of qualities and mapping that onto your own experience. And then slowly things take shape. But it can be, it can be years from when you first come across something to when you've got a sense of, I think I know what that means. I wouldn't say it's not worthwhile making those kind of joining up the dots and seeing whether they fit. And also being prepared to say, well, it was a neat pattern, but I don't think that's how the dots are supposed to be joined up in that particular puzzle. It's supposed to be a horse, and I've just produced an elephant. Yeah. Horses don't have tusks. I must have got something wrong in that picture. Yes.
I think I produce two hands chorus, not only one word.
Say that again.
About the dependent or mm-hmm. imaginations, I think my horse has two heads. Because there is two different teaching, more teaching, and more different translation of word of the anicca, about sankhara mm-hmm. and bhava, and so I start to think about all these things. And it seems like sankhara is still the mind, if there is it's translated as mental formation, I would say. And another translation is intention. And then consciousness, namarupa, is also the mind there. And then Sayatana, it's also mind is there, because the six senses is also the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all conditioned, the mind conditioned mind, the mind the mind. And then Avijja, it cannot not be present. It's always present. And so it just seems to be just Avijja conditions something. And if there is wisdom, there is not something anymore. No condition.
That's pretty much it. Yes.
So you just stay in the heart and see what's happening, and nothing else is important. Just be present in the moment. So it's just if you go that, I think it's just mental.
So yeah, if you try to figure it all out logically, just from the, as you say, that there's so much overlapping, and how is this mind different from that mind, or that the in the nama khandas of nama rupa, you've got feeling, perception, you've got sankhara in the nama. And so there's a lot of overlapping. So that's why the way I mapped it out in this little diagram, I felt it was just bringing those first four together and just essentially lumping it in the form of, well, this is how, when there's ignorance, the subject-object dynamic gets formed. There's an experiencer and an experienced. And that's, in a way, also like Ajahn Chah saying, you're falling out of a tree, trying to count the branches and twigs on the way down. It's too refined. It's too complicated. It happens too fast. But to just summarize that whole first part of the process is that if there's unmindfulness, if the attention drifts, then there's a me here and a world out there. Or there's a me looking at my mind. The sense of the subject, the doer, the experiencer, and the thing that is experienced, that becomes quite so clearly divided. And that's as much as we really need to know. So I felt that in the many times I've sort of taught this, I found it's far easier just to, and more realistic, more practical to work with it in those terms, rather than trying to pick out every detail. So does the Vedana in the Nama of Nama Rupa, how is that different from the Vedana that comes after Salayatana on Pasa? Is it the same? Is it different? Is it stronger? Is it, and so that you can spend a lot of energy trying to figure out all those details. But so I found that just making these four basic chunks of setting up the subject-object dynamic, and then the process of perception and feeling, and then once feelings have been chased after, tana upadana bhava, the kind of mind getting lost, in its objects of aversion or desire or fear or opinion, any of those outflows, and then the result of having got lost, jati jara marna soka parideva dukkha domana subhayasa. So that's to get a feeling for how the process works and then mapping that onto our experience. I think just using that, the basic four chunks. But as you were saying, I think, sister, you got to kind of, in terms of practicing, just be awake as much as possible. The more that vijja is established, then the whole process doesn't get going. It's not being fueled by avijja, by that ignorance, and that whole solidifying of the subject-object division, a me here and a world there, that isn't being brought into form. It's not arising, and so there's the quality of clarity and peacefulness is established and ongoing.
The more I thought about it, the more foolish I felt.
The more what?
Foolish.
Foolish.
Foolish. And it's just away from the Dhamma. Mm-hmm. Got lost in thought. Mm-hmm. I see that it's dangerous. Learning Dhamma can be also dangerous.
Yes. Yeah. There's also one of a very helpful little passage, a saying in the Anguttara Nikaya, I think it's in the Book of the Fours, where the Buddha says, don't complicate the uncomplicated. Apapanchang papancheti. Don't complicate the uncomplicated. So it's always a risk when talking about dependent origination. It can get overcomplicated. But hopefully with the next chapters, we start off with the next ones are I start talking about the four exit points from the cycle. And so that is hopefully dwelling more on practicalities rather than just the theoretical background. That's my aim anyway. Any other questions, thoughts?
I have one question.
Yes.
Yes. If I understood correctly, you said something when in the practice, we shouldn't try to localize or conceptualize things, like put things in words and thinking and concept. And then the first week of the retreat, I remember that you said that we should learn the dependent origination and then reflect which state we are, and then so I followed that and I was busy with thinking the whole time. And then yesterday was something else, and then I was confused, and I didn't know what's the right approach.
Well, I apologize if I'm being inconsistent, but I'm following in the footsteps of my beloved and respected teachers, particularly Lumpo Sha, who was completely unafraid of being totally inconsistent. Because seriously, I think that there's a time for, like, say, getting acquainted, getting familiar with these basic concepts and getting to know them, and a time to leave the words alone. And what I was talking about yesterday, I think, again, it's hard to remember exactly what I said to whom and when, but particularly when there's the painful emotional feelings, it's around that area, or when we've made a mistake, or we've caused suffering to ourselves or others. It's very, at least for myself and many other people, it's very easy for the thinking mind to kind of jump in and start kind of criticizing ourselves or telling a whole story of how we're going to do it all different in the future or how it's somebody else's fault. And so in that respect, I was saying the more wordless it is that we just experience the painful result of unskillful action. So, you know, you said something, you know, you've shouted at somebody, and then you feel bad, they feel bad, and so then that feeling in the heart, in the citta, is, ow, that hurts. And so what I was saying then, rather than trying to analyze it or make a, you know, a, or make a whole kind of program to not do that again in the future in our thoughts and ideas, you know, we might have a like a wholesome intention with that. But my experience has been that that complicates things. That's like complicating the uncomplicated. And what teaches us more often is pain. It'd be nice to learn from pleasure, but most of us learn more effectively from painful feeling than we do from pleasant feeling. I'm not the first person to make that observation. So we can learn from pleasant feeling, but we tend to learn more completely from dukkha, from painful feeling. And so in that respect, just to let that genuinely be known with no excuses, no regrets, no self-hatred, just that was done, this is the effect, ow. And just to let that, like not to distract your mind with something else, but just to let yourself feel it. And to let that painful feeling have its effect. So in that instance, the less words, the better. You can still use some words like, it's like this. It's always helpful. Bin yang ni eng. It's this way. This is the way it is. And so then in that circumstance, then the less concepts, words that are there, then the more directly that painful feeling has its impact. And as Lumpur Cha said, until we really know the pain of attachment, we won't let go. That's one of his many wonderful sayings. So it's not that we want to feel discomfort, or that if it was more effective to learn through pleasant experience, that would be good. But often it is through frustrations or regrets and those emotional pains that we learn very directly. And I feel it's not just for me, but I think for many, many people, the more direct and uncomplicated that is, the more it's just received in a direct way. And I think I used the example of like touching a hot fire, that you don't have to think that's hot. Already you pulled your hand away because you know it's hot. So that learning is a non-conceptual, intuitive, instinctive learning. Does that make sense?
About just one thing during the practice, I just want to have a quick question. For instance, Rumpu Sumedho often say this like this. So during the day when I try to be mindful and when something comes up, I say anger is like this, and this conceptualized or verbalized or not, or I just observe how this the sensation more.
Well, that's a pretty simple statement. So I think just to focus the attention, just a couple of words like that. Yeah, I wouldn't say that's out of place, but to the degree possible to let oneself feel the experience. But using a thing like it's like this or anger feels like this, and just using that to direct the attention to that state and then leaving it alone is. I do that kind of thing a lot. Speaking of inconsistency, just to tell a little story. So my last conversation with Lumpur Cha in 1979, so I had had the plan to come back and visit England, because when I left in 1977, I had no idea I was going to become a Buddhist monk and such like. I was going to travel around the world for a few years and see what happened. Anyway, so Chithurst Monastery had been opening up, and that we'd heard about. That was all happening, and so I and my grandmother had written me a letter saying, "I'd like to see you again before I get too old and die." And that, being very sort of restless and lonely at Mopopong and got this aerogram with my granny. My granny needs me. So that dropped a match into the hay barn, as they say. And so anyway, I got this idea that I'd like to go back to England and also to meet... I know I'd never met Kompo Sumedho at that point. As he'd already gone to England by the time I had arrived. So I had this idea to go back to England. So just before the rains retreat began, I went to Silom Pocha, and I had my whole script. I had my kind of everything worked out to persuade him. This is a really great idea. Even though I hadn't even got one rains as a monk, I'd been ordained as a monk in April. I was going to have my whole script to persuade him. This was a wonderful idea for me to go back and live with Ajahn Sumedho in England. And to my surprise, I couldn't speak Thai very well at all. But I had another monk there to translate. He didn't need any persuading at all. He just said, all right, but go after the Pansa, not now. So I had to wait another 3 months before I could travel. So anyway, it was sort of in my mind to be going back to England after the rains retreat had finished. And I was I was so impatient, I became convinced that the moon wasn't changing sides. The last week of the rains, it's like, it's not changing, it's the same size. It's not growing. It's supposed to be nearly full. It's like the same as it was yesterday. Which is ridiculous, but it felt that way. It's like, it's not changing. Each day was like 5 years. I was, a restless 22-year-old, so it was par for the course, I think, in that situation. Anyway, so finally, I got a telegram there at the monastery just before I was about to, a week or so before I was going to travel. I got a telegram from my sister saying that our father was very ill, and could I come straight away? So he'd had a heart attack. So I went scooting down from the little branch monastery where I was living in Royette and went to go and pay respects to Lompo Cha to ask to go back to England immediately. So anyway, this is a bit of a preamble, but so my last dialogue with Lompo Cha took place. I'd come down from the branch monastery in Royette province and went to see him, paid respects. And again, my Thai was very, very poor, but Ajahn Jagaro, as he was then, was translating for me. And Ajahn Chah spoke for about 20 minutes. And Ajahn Jagaro said, well, essentially he said four things. He said, go to England, pay your respects to Ajahn Sumedho, spend time with your family, and then come straight back to Thailand. And then the second thing he said was, go to England, pay respects to Ajahn Sumedho, go and spend time with your family. You can spend a year there around your family and with Ajahn Sumedho, and then after a year, you should come back to Thailand. And the third thing he said was, go to England, pay respects to Ajahn Sumedho, go and visit your family, come back, live with Ajahn Sumedho at this new monastery, and you should stay there. But if it gets really difficult, it's really a problem, then you can come back to Thailand if you really need to. And the fourth thing he said was, go to England, pay respects to Ajahn Sumedho, go see your family, go live at the new monastery and don't come back. And it was all with exactly the same expression. Like, there was no change of tone. There was no indication that he was totally contradicting himself at all. It was just, these are your instructions, follow them to the letter. That was a very good Lumpur Chara inconsistency mode. So basically, you go and figure it out. You go and see what happens, and you figure it out. Make your own choices. Any other questions? Yes, Venerable.
Trying to tie this together somehow, because I feel there's a theme about being able to kind of guide ourselves in the right way. So the Dharma is so multicolored, and there's different instructions at different times, and even the Buddha contextualized his teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, how do we know when to apply what? Especially in the context of when there is...
When the teacher gives you four different instructions that are mutually contradictory.
So is it a matter of, like, no matter what happens, there is a kind of, like, if one has a certain kind of trust in the teachings and one sort of has whatever is in one's reservoir to be able to be applied no matter which circumstance arises, or...
Well, it's a good question. One of the things that I campaign against is the idea that there is a thing that I should be doing. You know, when people say, it was meant to be, Ajahn, I scowl. I don't mean to, but well, sometimes I do. Because in Buddha Dhamma, there isn't a meant to be. There might be a predisposition or an inclination towards some activity or some event. But the Buddha spent 45 years teaching to counter the beliefs in predestination and fixity of karma and such like. And so that there isn't a right thing for me to do, or for you to do, or for any of us to do. Or there might be a right thing, but it only lasts for a nanosecond, and then something else is the right thing. And so that so I feel that's helpful in terms of, rather than thinking, oh, there is the right thing for me to do, or there's the right place for me to be, or the right Ajahn, the right Rinpoche for me to be with, the right Lama. So I feel it's very helpful to just let go of that, if that structure exists, or that set of ideas exists, to let go of that. And instead, what this and that kind of inconsistency points to is essentially, figure it out on your own as you go along. Because if you have the principle to learn from whatever happens, then you're not being foolish. You're not just sort of making trouble for yourself. You're not sort of going out in the freezing cold with just a t-shirt on. You know, if it's freezing cold, ice and snow, you dress for it. Or if it's baking hot, then you dress for it. But if you have the basic principle of being ready to learn from everything, then you make a choice and you see what happens. And you see whether that choice led to something beneficial or something harmful. If it's led to something harmful, okay, what do I learn from that? Because if it led to something beneficial, what do I learn from that? And so rather than there being like a fixed path that we should be following, that is the right way, the right thing for me to do, then it's essentially being attuned to each moment and learning what can be learned from the fabric of each situation. And then when we realize we've made choices or things are happening that are continually obstructive and difficult, then that tells you this isn't a particularly helpful situation and maybe I should think about being somewhere else. Or the opposite, if this is really great, this is marvelous, something in me wants to hang on to this forever, okay, be aware of that. But at the moment, this is really good. So let's stay with this. And so that, figuring it out as you go along, it might seem a bit vague, but I feel that that's, in a sense, the best way that we can work as human beings. Or it's like, if you're in an orchestra, you know what the music is on the score, but what's the conductor doing today? Like, whoa, he's on steroids today. I've got to keep up, everyone's like, it's extra ramped up. Okay, I was feeling kind of calm, but whoa, okay, this one's really moving, so I better get with it. Or that it's really benign. The conductor's really, everything's really, really calm. Oh, that's right. The first violinist. She just had her partner just passed away. So she's very sad. So there's a somber quality to our playing today. So okay, go with that. So you're attending to the situation you're in, and you're learning from what goes on. So say for example that situation of me coming back from Thailand, I'd never met Lumpur Sumedha. His reputation was really frightening. I was actually quite worried because there were these stories of when they were living in Hampstead, they would have these ten-hour sittings, like sit for 5 hours, then you could have 5 minutes to go to the bathroom and shift your posture, and then come back and have another 5 hour sitting. But he felt they were getting a bit stodgy and they needed to ramp up their practice. You know, cold showers at 3 o'clock in the morning to kind of rouse the vigor. I thought, such and tomato is really, I'm not sure if I want to be around here. Yeah, you know, very worldly considerations. Seriously, I'm not kidding. Those are the stories that were coming through to us from the monks who were living there. And from Ajahn Sumedho as well. But when I met him, at the end of, you know, October of 79, and then I first went to Chithurst, after my dad had recovered from his heart attack, when he was off the critical list, my mother collapsed. So she was in one hospital. She had like a bowel seizure. So she had surgery and she was in one hospital. My dad was in another hospital. So my sisters and I were shuttling back and forth for a month between these Pembrey Hospital and Ashford Hospital in Kent. So when that was all over, and both parents had recovered and things had settled a bit, then I moved into Chithurst. And Lumpur Sumedho was in his late 40s. And he was giving like 2 Dhamma talks a day, every day. Every morning at the kind of work meeting. We didn't have breakfast. So we had tea in those days. Every evening there was a Dhamma talk every night. And so within a very short period of time, I had this feeling of like, I am going to stay here. Whatever it takes to stay with this, this doesn't happen twice in a lifetime. So whatever I need to do to stay here, this is something to stay with. And then, so that was one of the things, you know, Lumpur Chah said, you go and figure it out, you know. And so then it was really clear, this is really unique and incredibly wonderful situation. There was only about, there was 4 nuns and who were all newly ordained Anagarikars. There was 7 monks, 8 monks, about 7 or 8 lay people living there. So it was an incredible sort of Dhamma fest. But week after week after week. There was this feeling of like, this isn't going to happen twice in a lifetime. Just stay with this. Stay here, because this is good. So I could see there was I want to keep this. But also, it didn't mean to say I should move away, but rather, okay, this is the situation that's taken shape. This is wonderfully beneficial. This is, this is really a marvelous and incredibly, powerful time of learning, and so great. Make hay while the sun shines, as they say. I'm sure there's a German equivalent. Make hay while the sun shines. I could have thought, oh well, Ajahn Chah's health is not good. I should go back to Thailand and want to draw close to him. I should learn Thai language. But I didn't. I just decided, other people did. And like someone like Ajahn Jayasaro, he decided, very early on, he was going to learn Thai as well as he could, and he was going to spend as much time as close to Ajahn Chah as he could, because he felt that he really wanted to be close to him as a teacher. And so he made that choice, and he developed brilliant skills with the Thai language and spent a lot of time close to Lumpur Chah. And so that we make our own individual choices, and then we get the benefits and blessings from that. But the most important thing is to establish that basis of learning from whatever happens along the way, and not in a sense limiting your what you want to learn from things that sort of fit your ideal, like that I need to have this situation to practice, or I need to be with this kind of a teacher or this kind of an environment. But if you have that, I find that sense of whatever is happening, let that be my teacher, which is what Yen Lumpur Chah and Lumpur Sumedho would say over and over again. Then you have a very, it requires a lot more self-reliance. You have to sort of use your own wisdom, your own intuition for what's a beneficial situation. You can't just follow a program or follow a system. You've got to use your own initiative and look at your own experience. but then also the results of setting that intention to learn from whatever happens, then it makes a very sort of rich and illuminating life. You learn a lot along the way. And so you're not stuck in situations. If things are really not working, then of course you can make choices and go different places or find different arrangements. But you're not setting up that idea of somewhere else there's this really good place where everything's going to be right. Which is a way of putting the real practice of Dhamma out of one's reach, if that makes sense. That was a long answer, but it's a good question.
And the amazing thing is, Ajahn, that what you said at the end, even like my question was actually aiming at something different, and yet the answer was perfect. Mm-hmm. So even within that, kind of like what is the how am I being set up? In terms of like my own openness and letting go of my predispositions in any moment, and at the same time kind of acknowledging also the predispositions that we have, and like at any moment in time, even being like taking the example of the sunset,
mm-hmm.
like my predisposition might be to not get touched, and then it might be a good idea to actually look at the sunset and enjoy the beauty. And at the same time, be aware that it's changing. Or my predispositions would be to be completely like high on dopamine all the time. In which case, it might be a good idea to, maybe narrow my view a little bit. So I was also sort of getting at that aspect. And yet, what you said was super helpful. Thank you.
Okay, so 7 o'clock has come around again, amazingly. As it does every day. So let's leave it there. And the next chapter is called The First Exit Point from the Cycle. So let's leave it there for today.
Andamayan Dhamma Uvada Kataya Sadhu Karanda Dhamase
Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu Anumodam.